This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We will talk about the role of diet and nutrition in a variety of chronic illnesses. What I'd like you to do is think about this talk tonight as what I call the tiebreaker. That is, I'm sure you've heard all sorts of different opinions about all sorts of different things, and I'm going to tell you my opinion, which hopefully is going to be based in science and the rigor of clinical trials and how we know what we know in medicine. And I'll, when it's just opinion, I'll be sure to tell you that as well. And as with the other talks I've given, I have no conflicts of interest with any of the material I'm going to speak about. So let me begin just with a point of reflection. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but one of the let me just start with the question as written. So just think for a moment, if you will, and just to yourself, how would I describe my diet? Would you say that it's balanced and healthy? Not as healthy as I want it to be, vegetarian, pesco-vegetarian, Mediterranean, low-carbohydrate, low-glycemic index, gluten-free, paleo, or none of the above? Exactly. Well, I think that's one of the important points. So the comment out front was all of the above. And I think one of the points of this slide is that diets have taken on a tremendous number of names, mostly commercial, mostly in an attempt to sell diet books and diet supplements and the like, but also for academic reasons. So we find ourselves heavily polarized in the medical community between those who recommend one diet type over another. And what I would like to do by the end of the talk is recommend what I consider a common sense diet, or what I call medically a generic diet, that is a commercial-free diet, that I hope will reinforce much of what you already know. The other point about this slide is if you as a patient answered this question that your doctor might ask you, or your clinician might ask you, and you might say, well, I'm a vegetarian, your doctor actually wouldn't know a whole lot about what you ate. And so that these categories, when you group people within them, even with the same label, can represent an extremely wide range of variation within the diet. So there's probably as much variation, this is now opinion, but as much variation amongst vegetarians, say, as there might be amongst those who say they eat a balanced, healthy diet. So the labels don't mean much to us clinically. They're the first question, but it requires drilling down and getting much more granular as to what the patient's actually eating. And we'll come back to this with some illustrations as we go through some diets or nutrients. Why do we care about what we eat? Or why would nutrition be part of a course in preventive medicine? The reason is because the most common causes of death in the United States are diseases that we think are related to nutrition and or exercise. And about a third of preventable deaths in the United States have been attributed to poor nutrition and physical inactivity. And of course, no surprise that at the top of the list is heart disease and cancer, also stroke and diabetes. Accidents actually have a relationship to alcohol use, so that could also be highlighted as well. As I mentioned, a third of premature deaths are estimated to be due to poor nutrition and physical inactivity. Now, there's been a little bit of a tension in the preventive medicine community as to what's more important, diet and exercise or cigarettes. And this is not a worthwhile conversation to have. There's no question that cigarettes remain the number one cause of preventable deaths and disease, not only in the United States, but worldwide. And so even though it is true that patients typically gain 7 to 10 pounds upon quitting smoking, there is absolutely no question that there is greater harm from the cigarettes than there is from the 7 to 10 pounds. And there's really no exceptions to that. But having said that, diet and exercise are clearly second, and they've increased in importance over the last three decades or so. Most Americans don't get the recommended amount of physical activity, and depending on how you define a, quote, healthy, balanced diet, only about 10% of Americans meet federal nutrition recommendations. And again, I'll define those in some detail. And again, no surprises. The dietary sins are too many calories, too much saturated and trans fat, too much salt and too much refined sugar and refined carbohydrate, and too little fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and fiber. And so I'll spend a fair amount of time on each of these elements and try to put some specifics on each of them. So I'll for a bit of a roadmap, I will go through some of these more quickly than others, but I want to say a few words about calories and what I'll call macronutrients and macronutrient balance. We'll talk about dietary fiber. We'll talk about the history of U.S. dietary guidelines and the most recent guidelines that were published last month in draft form. Dietary sodium. We'll talk about vegetarian diets and Mediterranean diets. And then we'll talk about supplements, a few words about antioxidants and B vitamins, fish oil, and vitamin D and calcium. And then at the end, I'll make some general concluding remarks about some basic principles and what I'll call the generic diet. So just a word or two about calories, no surprise here. In the last 30 years, the average American, this is from per capita data, has increased calorie intake on an average of 500 plus 600 calories a day. Remember that a pound of fat, when burned in a bomb calorimeter, is worth 3,500 calories. So if you eat 500 calories extra per day for a week, you can predict that you will gain a pound. So on Thanksgiving, when people eat 6,000 calories a day, that works out to about a pound if, in fact, what you really needed that day was 2,000 calories. So most people need about 2,000 calories a day to maintain your body weight even. As you get older, you need less. Short people need less than tall people. People with less muscle need less than people with more muscle. So in general, women need less than men. So for women who are short, the amount of calories per day you need to break even is strikingly low. And it may be as low as 1,400, 1,500 calories a day just to break even. So if you're trying to lose weight and all you need to break even to maintain your current weight is 1,500 calories a day, you have to get down pretty low to create an energy deficit. And remember that 500 calorie rule works in the other direction as well. In order to lose a pound of fat, you need to have an energy deficit of 3,500 calories. And so if you need 1,500 to break even and you go on 1,000 calories per day for a week, you can predict that you would lose 1 pound per week. Now, there are some subtleties to those equations. It changes a bit depending on how long you've been on it and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is, it's a lot easier to gain weight than it is to lose weight. Now, if you look at per capita consumption data, and this isn't necessarily true for all individuals and certainly all patients, but if you look at per capita sources of calories in the United States, what you see is the pattern shown here. And you'll see this list again, and it looks pretty similar when we start looking at least one or two other nutrients. But the top calorie sources per capita of individuals in the United adults in the United States is are desserts, breads, chicken and chicken mixed dishes, and this is in part because it's a very common fast food, soda and energy drinks and sport drinks, pizza, again, because it's a very common fast food, Alcohol has calories too. We won't go into this in great detail, but generally it's about the same as a Pepsi. If you drink a glass of wine and you drink an equal amount of Pepsi, it's about the same amount of calories, which isn't to say you shouldn't have wine, but you should be thinking about where it fits into your energy budget for that day or week. Pasta and pasta dishes, Mexican mixed dishes, again, fast food, beef and beef dishes, and dairy desserts. So you can see, and this is a point I'll make about six ways going, is that if you focus, if I say nothing else to you for the rest of the evening, but you focus your attention on eating, not eating, sugary foods and foods with refined carbohydrate, we're done. You will have improved your diet so much just by doing those two things, on average, that we don't have to talk about a lot of the other subtlety. Now, we will talk about all the other subtlety, but by far and away from a public health perspective, but also from an individual clinical perspective, if you avoid sugary foods and refined carbohydrate foods, your diet will be much healthier, your total calorie intake will be likely to go down. It's hard to replace those calories and not be negative. And typically, you replace them with higher fiber foods, whole grains, fruits and vegetables, and the nutrient density is less. That is, the amount of calories per gram of food or the amount of nutrients per calories. But all the desserts and breads and soda pop and so forth all fall into that category. From my opinion, there's really very little reason for sucrose to be on the planet. Remember that when we say sweetened beverages and sweetened desserts and so forth, all the sugars are the same, whether it's from a nutritional or a calorie standpoint, whether it's sucrose, fructose, honey, beet, cane, it doesn't matter. It's all 4 calories per gram, and it's all causes all the metabolic side effects that you've heard so much about from sugar. That doesn't mean that the occasional dessert to be for a celebratory isn't reasonable. I think thinking of dessert as celebratory is a perfectly reasonable way to do that. Everyone deserves a wedding cake and a birthday cake and some pecan pie on Thanksgiving or whatever your favorites are. But having dessert every night doesn't make nutritional sense, at least in the United States in 2015. And the same is true with refined grains, and we'll say much more about that later in the talk. Now, of course, one of the big things that's changed over the course of the last several decades is where people eat. And so a lot of the good nutrition and the healthy eating movement has really tried to focus on getting people to eat at home and prepare their own meals. This, of course, is something we did as a society without question until relatively recently, and it's had a major impact on our nutrition. And if nothing else, then certainly our calories. And you can see that on average, again, this is based on consumption data per capita, on average, people eat a lot more in a restaurant than one does at home. Now, that's not always true in San Francisco, where the portions are so small that you can get away with a little less, as long as you don't buy the prefix meal, because then a third of your calories are coming from dessert, and you didn't need those calories. But you can see the amount is substantially higher when you eat at a restaurant. So that's one of the habits to change is start shopping more again, planning meals again, think about recipes before you go to the store, plan tomorrow's meal tonight, and so on. And that'll be a big healthy step for many people of any income. And it's something we're really trying to teach patients assertively. Now, a lot of the diet book industry has focused not so much on total calories as on the mix of what I'll call macronutrients in the diet. A macronutrient which stands for those big molecules from which calories derive. So by that I mean dietary fat, dietary carbohydrate, and dietary protein. Those are the three main macronutrients. The fourth macronutrient is alcohol, which is another substance from which calories are derived from the body. So there are really four sources of calories in the human diet. Certainly, if you look at the history of diet books, way back into the late 50s and early 60s, and some great shows on the Johnny Carson show, where Stillman and Atkins were in food fights with each other, and then poor Mr. Scarsdale got involved, and then his wife, his mistress, assassinated him, but the history of the low carbohydrate diet has been around for decades. And that's a good example of a macronutrient controversy. That is to say, maybe if we ate less carbohydrates, we would have less calories. And remember, if you take alcohol out of the equation for a second, there are only three of these, three macronutrients. Generally speaking, protein is held roughly constant. So with some exceptions, because protein can also go up and down, but generally if alcohol's out and you hold protein sort of constant and you keep calories the same, then by definition, low carbohydrate means higher fat, and low fat means higher carbohydrate. And that's where a lot of this tension has been in the diet wars, if you will, the nutrition controversies over the last 30, 40 years. And so, as you know, the dietary guidelines have been recommending low-fat diets until relatively recently, although not 2015, well before that, and we'll go over that in a moment. But in contrast, many of the diet books have focused on low-carbohydrate. Now, this has been studied with over two to three dozen randomized clinical trials now, taking people who are overweight or have some metabolic abnormality, randomizing them to a low-carbohydrate diet or a normal diet or a high-fat diet and seeing what happens. And the bottom line is study after study, and all the studies when combined together show that there's no difference in terms of weight loss based on or any markers of metabolic abnormality based on the macronutrient composition of the diet on average. Now, in individual patients with individual circumstances, there are exceptions to that. But on average, what predicts who will lose weight in those kind of studies is not the type of diet they were assigned to, but their adherence to the diet they were assigned to. And so if you adhere to a lower-calorie diet and you pick the right number, that is, you're eating now the amount of calories that's less than what you need, and that requires, as I suggested earlier, some insight, because many of you don't need very many to break even, then it doesn't matter that much whether you do it with a lower-fat diet, like a vegetarian or a vegan diet, or a somewhat higher-fat diet, like a low-carbohydrate diet, such as South Beach or Atkins, or even some of the paleo diets. So the key, though, is to adhere to the diet and ultimately to take in less calories than you require. Now, there are some subtle differences between how fats, carbohydrate, and protein are metabolized, but they are trumped by the behavioral issues of adherence. So the subtle differences that can be shown biochemically between one macronutrient and another don't matter clinically, because if you follow the diet and eat, say, 12 or 1,400 calories a day when you need 2,000 or 1,800, you will lose weight, and it doesn't matter what that diet is made of. Now, clearly, you want to select foods which are healthy foods. And so when I say eat whatever you want, as long as it's lower in calories, I don't mean junk food and the things that we've already eliminated in our thinking. But if you're eating healthy foods, it doesn't matter that much whether it's lower in carbohydrates or lower in fat. All right, word or two about dietary fiber. Some might argue that this is the most important nutrient of all. Dietary fiber is plant matter that's not digested by the human body. So you eat this stuff, and it goes right through you. There are some exceptions to that. Some forms of fiber can be digested to a certain extent by gut bacteria. And some of the names that you'll see when we think about dietary fiber are cellulose, hemicellulose, pectins, gums, mucociliages, and lignins. And generally, they're classified as either soluble or insoluble. And that mostly reflects to whether you can dissolve them in water. And that predicts how they act in the body. So both forms of fiber increase transit time through the gut and are excellent for constipation, for regular bowel habits, for irritable bowel syndrome, diverticular disease, and so on. But the soluble fibers in particular have advantages because they also interfere with the reabsorption or reabsorption of certain fats and carbohydrates, so that they're associated with improved blood sugar control in diabetics and reduced cholesterol in people with high LDL cholesterol. So ideally, you want a mix of both soluble and insoluble fiber in the day, in your diet. Now, the dose, the current requirement or the current recommended allowance, if you will, for dietary fiber, as published by the Institute of Medicine, is strikingly high. The average intake in the United States is about 12, 15 grams a day, and the requirements are roughly double that. So you need to work pretty hard to meet your fiber requirement, and I'll show you some examples of the numbers in just a moment. But this ultimately may be the most important nutrient and one that is, again, if you're going to focus on sort of a shortcut, then much akin and complementary to focusing on avoiding sweeteners and avoiding refined carbohydrate. Another way to look at that is to increase your dietary fiber. Those will have complementary effects or the very similar effects on changing your dietary pattern. We know from a variety of metabolic studies that, as I mentioned, in patients with high cholesterol, that dietary fiber lowers the LDL cholesterol and also lowers the triglycerides. In diabetes, it reduces blood sugar. It has a variety of beneficial effects on the GI tract for constipation, hemorrhoids, and diverticular disease. And it also is thought to be helpful in weight loss diets because it improves satiety. It gives you a sense of fullness. Now, just by way of example, this was a relatively recent study, and I had the privilege of writing an editorial, so I just thought I would highlight this one. But this was a summary of 22 observational studies. So these are not randomized trials. So this is a weaker form of evidence. That is where groups of people are followed forward to see what happens. A randomized trend experiment would be where you take two groups and give one of them high fiber and one of them not. That's how the other findings, these findings, were identified by randomized trials. But from observational studies, we also have a wide body of literature suggesting that based on dietary report, that patients who report taking in a higher dietary fiber intake have less cardiovascular disease. So there's a fairly broad body of evidence to suggest that dietary fiber can prevent heart disease and stroke. What was nice about this particular study was that they tried to quantify that a little bit and were able to show that a certain dose of fiber, in this case 7 grams of dietary fiber, a mix of soluble and insoluble, was associated with about a 10% reduction in cardiovascular events. Remember I mentioned that at the first or second week that statins, which we think saves lives, prevents heart attack, and prevents stroke, lower your risk of a heart attack or a stroke by a third. And so here now we have not as strong evidence, but a line of thinking based on observational evidence that 20 grams of dietary fiber may have a roughly similar effect or and so on. So if your diet is relatively low in fiber, One thing that you can focus on is eating more dietary fiber. 7 grams of fiber is equal to a portion of whole grains and a portion of legumes, or 2 to 4 servings of fruits and vegetables. So it's not trivial. You have to try a little bit hard, that is through most meals of the day, to eat high fiber foods to get up to that 25 to 30 grams a day. And this is too hard to read here, but it's available for you when you click online. But just makes the point that even within healthy classes of foods, there's a range. So not all fruits are the same, not all vegetables are the same, not all cereals and grains are the same, and so on. So, for example, apples and blueberries are relatively high in dietary fiber, but oranges and grapes are grapes are relatively low. Pears and raspberries, again, are pretty high. When you look at breads, again, white bread versus wheat bread, there's a modest difference. If you add, though, if you buy a product where a brand has, or fiber has been specifically added, then you can get up to some relatively high numbers shown here for the wheat bran cereals, and the same is true for some of the breads that have supplemented fiber. As you can see, from breakfast cereals, there's a difference between cornflakes and oatmeal, but shredded wheat has more. The difference between brown rice and white rice is fivefold. That doesn't look like that much, but remember, a serving is relatively small, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So if you're eating a fair amount of whole grains, it contributes. Tree nuts are relatively high, and peanuts are quite high in fiber. Legumes are almost universally high in fiber, and some of the green leafy vegetables as well. Powdered psyllium is a product. One of the brand names is Metamucil, and there are a variety of others on the market. It's a soluble fiber that you can take mixed in juice or water or tea or whatever that to increase your dietary fiber. And we recommend this medically at times for patients as a quote, medicalized way to increase your dietary fiber. But you can see the dose, again, it takes, you gotta work on this a little bit, that a teaspoon of powdered psyllium is only 3 or 4 grams of fiber. And if you want to get up by 10 or 15, you need to slowly, progressively build that dose up. So you can think about this a little bit more, but you can begin to see the kind of choices you might make as to which breakfast cereal you might select, what fruit you might put in your breakfast cereal, and so forth. And what kind of the use of beans, green leafy vegetables, and nuts are all things you'll hear recur throughout the lecture. All right, let me switch now to dietary guidelines. If you look around the planet, to both in developing cultures and the developed world, but particularly in even some of the most isolated cultures in parts of Brazil or Indonesia or other locales such as that, the people who uniformly have a healthy diet compared to those who do not, the healthy diets have these features. People eat a wide variety of foods. They just don't eat that local root or white rice as their only calorie source. The food itself they eat is high in quality, and they eat the right quantity. And so those are three principles that make sense or that are observed from an anthropologic point of view, if you will, but also make sense in terms of thinking about one's own food choices. So, for example, when the four food groups were invented, and this was published after the war, after World War II in the 50s, was sponsored by and supported in large part by the dairy and beef industries, particularly the dairy industry, as a way to work with the government, the Department of Agriculture, to create a variety, greater variety in the American diet. So the problem with the four food groups, or the strength of the four food groups, is that it focused on variety. It said, don't eat one food group or two food groups, eat four food groups. And so that was what many of us learned in school. Dairy was often, always in the upper left-hand corner where the marketers thought there was the greatest visual appeal. And then the other three food groups were shown grains, meat, fish, and fowl, and fruits and vegetables. And again, the problem there is that there was a focus on, if we go back to our three principles, the four food groups speaks to variety, but it doesn't really say much about food quality or quantity. So there were a couple of others in between the four food groups and the pyramid, but the main intervention was the food pyramid, which came out in the 90s. And this was an attempt to get try a different visual image to make the same point, but now with a little bit more opinion about quality relative quantities. That is to say that the idea here was that one would eat low on the pyramid. So the foodstuffs at the bottom of the pyramid, which is where the grains and cereals were, should be the bulk of your intake, then the fruits and vegetables, and then moderate amounts of dairy and meat, fish, and fowl. And at the top of the pyramid is sugars and oils and sweets, and those should be used sparingly. And if you read some of the fine print here, there was a lot of value here, but it didn't answer all the questions. For example, if you can see at the bottom under grains and cereals, it says 6 to 11 servings. So it didn't do a really good job of saying, well, is it 6 or is it 11? It was that kind of issues, and after about a decade and a half of using the pyramid, the American diet did not really change very much, except in the wrong direction. I took out the slide which shows what we were actually eating, which was an upside-down pyramid with tons of fats, oils, and sweets, and most of the grains and cereals were refined carbohydrates, so just the things that we now are pretty clear about wanting to avoid. So in 2010, MyPlate came out, and this is the next step by the Federal Nutrition Programs to teach the public about dietary guidelines. And MyPlate is pretty good. And if you go to myplate.gov, there's a lot of very interesting nutrition information there, and I recommend the site. The idea here is that at least half your intake should be fruits and vegetables, that there should be grains and protein, and some dairy. Again, it's not quite as specific in this particular simple graphic as to what goes into each of those categories. But if you drill down a little bit, and this doesn't project well, but it is on the website, or if you print it out on a larger font, there's good advice here that's consistent with the dietary guidelines that I'll review in a moment, at least half your grains should be whole grains, that the vegetables should be a wide variety of vegetables, lots of different colors, similarly with a variety of fruits, dairy, predominantly lower-fat dairy or non-fat dairy, and lean meat, fish, and fowl, and protein alternatives such as tofu and legumes and so forth. So there's a lot of detail there, and you can punch in your height and weight and some dietary preferences and come up with some free nutrition advice as to how to achieve these guidelines. So the main points of the guidelines in 2010, this is still active, and the 2015 guidelines, which I'll show in just a moment, reinforce most of these principles. So this is not out of date, although there are one or two changes. So the guidelines focus on enjoy food but eat less, make half your plate fruits and vegetables, consume beans, whole grains, nuts, and seeds, increase the intake of seafood and fat-free and low-fat milk and milk products. Drink water instead of sugary drinks. One of Barron's rule is never drink any calories, except alcohol. compare sodium in foods and choose the lower. We'll talk more about that, and consume only moderate amounts of lean meat, poultry, and eggs. Now, in that latter category is where one of the changes are in the new guidelines, because eggs have made it back finally onto the okay list. So the new guidelines were just published about a month or so ago, and they've gotten some nice press. They're in draft form. The federal government now tends to put out recommendations in draft form and then lets the public review, comment, and then we'll send out a final version. And then presumably the support on the website behind the recommendations. So again, these are recommendations by a committee. They meet about every 5 years. And just to highlight the differences, so the main principles are the same. And again, the main principles being these. So these key principles are still the same, with a little bit of difference towards the bottom. So one of the differences that has gotten the most press has been that limitations on dietary cholesterol have been removed. Now, we've known for some time, there are only a few foods that have dietary cholesterol in them, or a few foods that people eat a lot of. Organ meats have a lot of dietary cholesterol, but people don't eat large quantities of them. And shellfish has a lot of dietary cholesterol, but they're very, very low in saturated fat. So the main issue for dietary cholesterol all these years has really been eggs. And I think part of it is that in some feeding studies, if you put people on different doses of eggs, the blood cholesterol, or the bad part of the blood cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, will increase. However, it's been known for decades that if you do that experiment while people are on a lower fat diet, especially a low saturated fat diet, that effect is muted. That is to say, if you're on a low saturated fat diet and eat dietary cholesterol, it has very little impact on your LDL cholesterol. So that's been known for some time, but it's finally made it into the guidelines. Clinically, we've been recommending people eat eggs for many, many years, but now it's an official part of the recommendation. So you no longer have to restrict eggs on a low cholesterol or a heart-healthy diet. They continue to reiterate consuming a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy, seafood, legumes, and nuts. No change there. Probably the thing to focus on, though, if you haven't been already, is the seafood, legumes, and nuts. So those are, we'll talk about some of the advantages of some of those foods in a few moments, but those are things to pay particular attention to and may provide an opportunity to improve one's diet. And consume a diet low in red or processed meats. That's an old recommendation. We'll comment on that in just a moment. Sugar-sweetened foods and beverages, no surprise there, and refined grains. So again, if you focus on sugar-sweetened foods and beverages and refined grains, you're going to accomplish a lot of the good here because you typically replace that with the things above it. Now, to get a little bit more quantitative, the recommendations are more specific in this version than they were 5 years ago in the amount of added sugars. The recommendation is less than 10% of calories. To me, that's still way too much. Again, as I mentioned, if you think of desserts as celebratory, you can get down to substantially less than that. And certainly no reason to drink sugary sweetened beverages. Saturated fat has been a little controversial, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But we still recommend, in some, a reduction of saturated fat. So the comment towards lean meat, fish, or fowl and low-fat or non-fat dairy is mostly an attempt to limit saturated fat in the diet and limit dietary sodium to a moderate amount, 2,300 milligrams per day, and I'll come back to that as well. As before, half of all grains should come from whole grains. You can make that number substantially higher. Again, there's very little reason to eat refined grains unless you're in an eating environment where that's your only choice. So, that's definitely happens, and that's fine. But when you have choices, there's little reason to eat refined grain. Moderate alcohol is a little bit controversial. Some recent observational evidence suggesting that maybe it's not as protective as we thought. Most of the literature for the last at least 20 years has suggested that people who drink moderately live longer and have less heart disease and stroke than people who don't, than teetotalers. And that's still the current thinking, but there's been some news or, you know, some question about maybe it's not as strong a benefit as we had thought. But the bulk of the evidence is still that moderate alcohol is both safe and may be beneficial. The competing issue with alcohol is that it does increase the risk of breast cancer in women. And so for people who are particularly high risk of breast cancer, that's could be an important factor. Remember, the principles of the first lecture are still true here. Remember when I went like this and I said, if someone says your risk is changed by a certain percent, you should immediately say, percent of what? And so if your risk of breast cancer is really, really low, increasing it by 20% may not matter very much because 20% bigger of a small number is still a small number. On the other hand, if your risk is high and you increase that by 20%, then that may be more important to you. And so this is all a matter of balancing risks and benefits. And very interesting, the recommendations are very explicit in a statement that's a little bit stronger than I would say in the office. I've been saying for years, and we've been known for years, that coffee is the Teflon nutrient. No matter what disease we try to pin on coffee, no one has been able to pin one. There are some, though, but the recommendation actually goes out of its way to say up to 5 cups of coffee per day is not associated with adverse effects in most adults. And again, there's some observational studies that actually go even further and say that coffee is associated with a reduction of cardiovascular disease and stroke. Of course, that's not true if you happen to be the one who gets atrial fibrillation from eating too much coffee or is very irritable all the day and commits domestic violence or can't sleep because, remember, caffeine has a half-life of 6 to 10 hours, and so people who have their coffee at the 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon slump and then wonder why they're having trouble falling asleep, that may be an important factor. So, but from an overall nutritional point of view, coffee is seems to be safe. So those are the new guidelines, and so most of the attention has come from this a little bit more quantitative approach on some of the nutrients and the elimination of the restriction on dietary cholesterol. So let me move next and say a word or two about grains, because this is important, but this is a tough topic. Not tough to understand, but tough to operationalize. Generally speaking, the recommendations are about half of your grains per day should be whole grain. And in the United States, almost all of the grain eaten is refined. The issue here, one of the issues here, although not the only one, is what is a serving of grain? So that if the recommendation to be on a 2,000-calorie diet, and remember, I don't think there's anyone in the room looking around who needs a lot more than 2,000 calories a day to maintain your energy requirement. So 2,000 is sort of a cap, especially as you get older, you know, unless you're really, really exercising extensively. So that means that most people should be eating no more than 6 1-ounce servings a day of grains, and half of those should be whole grains. The problem is that people don't know what a serving is. And so a serving of most grains is about what you can hold in your hand. Now, it doesn't matter if your hand is small or big. Just cup your hand, and that's about the amount that a serving is. And you'll be off by a little bit, but it doesn't matter. Because when you go to a Chinese or a Thai restaurant and they serve you some white rice, that's about 6 servings. Or if you go to a moderately priced pasta place and they give you a serving of spaghetti, that's 4 servings. So you're way, way out of whack, whether it's your hand or my hand. So it's a half a cup of cooked pasta, a half a cup of hot cereal, such as oatmeal, 1 tortilla, not 3 or 6 if you got, you know, 3 little tacos, one slice of bread, not, you know, you're already in two if you have a sandwich, a half a bun, a small muffin, you know, about that size. So, you know, the kind of muffins you get these days that are about that size are, again, about five servings of carbohydrate, not to mention all the sugar and fat. And then a cup of ready cereal. So one way to remember that is those little tiny single-serve boxes of Special K and cornflakes you get. I don't know if people still eat those very often, but that's a serving, right? So that tiny little bit you get that barely fills the bottom of your bowl, that's a serving of breakfast cereal. So it's a half a cup or half a baseball. So not much. Now, the second problem is people don't know how to select whole grains. Well, and the safest, and mostly here we're talking about wheat. Because, again, the you know, the basic science here is that a kernel of wheat has an outer covering, which is the bran or the dietary fiber. It has an inner core, which is the endosperm, which is where most of the healthy oils and vitamins and minerals are, and the rest of it is the starchy part of the wheat kernel, which is where all the plain carbohydrate is. And so when you refine carbohydrates, you take away the outer part, you take away the inner part. I said endosperm, I meant germ is the inner part, and the endosperm is the middle white part, if you will. And so you're throwing away the good stuff when you eat refined grains. The problem is that, at least as it goes for wheat, barley, wheat in particular, is that it's very deceptive the way most products are advertised. Because if you read wheat flour as the first ingredient, or if the product is brown in color, there's a natural tendency to think that you've just bought something healthier than something that's whiter or says refined wheat. So the key is to make sure that the first ingredient is whole, the word whole. So that more reliably represents that it's a whole grain. And then, of course, there are many other whole grains that are less commonly refined than wheat, and that's a terrific alternative for those who are on a higher carbohydrate diet and looking for dietary fiber. For those who are particularly quantitative, I don't recommend this necessarily to remember or even to use, but one can quantitate the amount of carbohydrates in a product to the amount of fiber, create a ratio of total carbs to fiber. And if it's less than 10 or less than 5, that suggests that the fiber intake is high. So you're looking for more fiber per calorie, per total carbs, than less. That's all I'm going to say about grains. So I think when you're shopping, this is one of the toughest issues to really look at a bread, especially if it's you know, a store-made bread, or to really try to figure out whether it's whole grain or not. It can be a challenge when you're shopping, even in this city. And certainly one of the ways to deal with that is eat less bread. And that way you won't have to deal with the issue quite as much. So I don't think of it quite as celebratory as desserts, but it certainly shouldn't be the mainstay of most diets unless you're quite confident that you're eating a whole grain bread and and other carbohydrate products. I'm not going to say much about sugar. Others have spoken on this in this course and elsewhere, and of course with the proposition in the city last fall and all the attention that investigators here at UCSF and elsewhere have gotten for their outstanding work demonstrating the relationship of sugar to both obesity and diabetes, I think this is pretty well appreciated. But the average person in the United States consumes 30 teaspoons of sugar and sweeteners per day, and it's over 15% of calories. As I mentioned, the new guidelines say less than 10%, but I would make that number substantially lower. And as I mentioned, it includes all the types of sweeteners, including cane and beet, sugar, high fructose corn syrup, which I didn't mention last time, dextrose, honey, and so forth. You can see there's some recommendations for really limiting the amount of sugar per day, and it should be quite low. Again, I think the way to think of this is a product, this being sucrose and high fructose corn syrup, are products that don't really need to be on the planet. Sweetened beverages are really a mistake. Now, I'm not going to say too much about artificial sweeteners, but I'm going to predict that someone will ask a question. So let me just say that the current thinking is that they're not much better. Now, the evidence supporting that statement is not as strong as for our knowledge that sugar is problematic. But there's certainly no evidence to suggest that if you take someone who consumes sugar and replaces it with one of the artificial sweeteners, you cannot find randomized trials that show any benefit from the artificial sweeteners. So the easy thing to say that is evidence-based is that there's really no benefit. So if you're a diabetic or if you're overweight, switching to it doesn't make sense. You would think instead of 150 calories, now I'm going to have zero calories. That should work, right? But when you do randomized trials on this, there's really not a lot of evidence to suggest that artificial sweeteners improve outcomes in diabetics or the obese. Now, whether they're safe in and of themselves, I think that's been an area of controversy. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest they're dangerous, but those are hard studies to do. And I think the more provocative issues is whether they themselves have unique metabolic effects not unlike sugar, whether there's some a customization or other impact of the artificial sweeteners that has a similar impact. That science is still developing. I think easier to understand, and this will be true even more so when we talk about sodium, is that if you're trying to stay away from sugary beverages and other sugary foods, then trying to retrain your taste buds away from sweet seems like a useful tactic. And that, to me, is one of the main ways to think about why I wouldn't want to eat a lot of artificial sweeteners, because it's going to maintain whether I can prove that it's bad, I can't do that yet, whether I can prove that it has metabolic consequences, I can't prove that yet. I can say it's not going to do you any good. But what I am concerned about is that it will maintain your behavioral preferences for sugary foods. So that may be the easiest way to think about why it's not worth it. So don't drink any calories, but diet sodas are not on the list. What about salt? This has been controversial, and this has been a bit of a pendulum swing in terms of how low should we go. It started getting a lot of attention again about 5 years ago when some of the investigators here at UCSF, particularly Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo and colleagues, did a nice study using a modeling. This is not a randomized trial, but a model. So they have big data sets and can insert various values of different intakes and then model what the impact would be on one's health. And this is from a public health point of view. And basically, it said that if one reduced sodium intake by a relatively small amount, you would have a modest decrease in blood pressure population-wide. And although for an individual patient trying to achieve a blood pressure goal, the effect may or may not be modest, and we discussed that the other night, about 5 millimeters of mercury, 5 to 10 at the most. But on a population base, if you can just shift that curve just a little bit over to the lower risk side, you prevent a lot of strokes and heart attacks. And so that's sort of the logic of eliminating sodium from the diet on a public health point of view. On a personal point of view, it makes the most sense if you have a condition that can be treated non-pharmacologically, that is without drugs, by taking in less salt, then that's a tool in your toolbox. So if you have high blood pressure and you want to stay off, take less medication, then a low salt diet may be an effective tactic for you, it only working in about a third to a half of people. But nonetheless, this article and similar articles have led to calls for more public policy approach. Let's just get the salt out of the food, that especially the salt we don't think about. And I'll say more about that. And we talked about this in the context of blood pressure, that, again, as I mentioned, getting salt down to about 2 grams or 2.5 grams of sodium per day lowers your blood pressure by about 2 to 8 milligrams millimeters of mercury, average about 5 or 6. And a healthy diet, the so-called dietary alternatives to stop hypertension, or so-called DASH diet, does about the same, and the two are additive. So eating a healthy diet will lower your blood pressure. Restricting sodium will lower your blood pressure on average with a bit of a range, and you can do them both together with additive benefit. Now, when the guidelines came out in 2010, a little controversy was created because this number 2,300 or 2 grams or so has been floated around, and it's the one you'll still see. And that the recommendation was, let's set that for the population at large. And that's a good number, and I'll come back to that number as being a good number in just a moment. And that's a good number because the average sodium intake is about 50% higher than that, so about 3.5 grams per day. And again, with a distribution amongst individuals and types of people, and you'll see which foods people are getting it from in just a moment. But then the guidelines in 2010 said, well, that's a good number in general, but for certain subpopulations, let's restrict even further and take it down to 1.5 grams. Now, 1.5 grams gets pretty hard to start doing. 1 gram is really hard to do without special foods, but 1.5 grams is already getting pretty hard. And what they recommended was that for people over age 51, African Americans, and patients with hypertension, diabetes, and kidney disease, they recommended this lower amount. The problem is all those exceptions result in half the population. So it was really a recommendation that a very large millions of Americans would need to be on this very low number. And as I mentioned, the average intake is 3.5 grams per day. In May of 2013, the Institute of Medicine said, wait a minute, that's too severe. Let's limit everyone to 2,300 milligrams a day, which is equivalent to a teaspoon of salt per day, instead of our average of 1.5 teaspoons. And so that is the current recommendation, and it's been repeated in the 2015 guidelines. So we do recommend sodium restriction. The controversy you'll hear about is between 2,300 and 1,500, but that's an irrelevant controversy, because most people eat more than 2,300. So if we can get you down to 2,300, job well done. Now, when you look at where we eat salt in the diet, it's quite humbling. I used to have a lecture about non-treatment of non-pharmacological treatment of hypertension. I remember I have this old slide back in the days when we had Kodachromes that said something like 1/3 of the salt in our diet naturally occurs in food, 1/3 occurs from processed food, and 1/3 occurs from adding salt at the table and the stove. And that was in the early 80s, I used to say that. And that's simply false. That is no longer true. And in fact, we're now up to about 3/4 or more of the sodium in the diet or salt in the diet coming from processed or prepared foods. So anything you eat that's in a bag or a box or a can or at a restaurant, unless it says in big letters low salt or low sodium, is high in sodium. And so the only way to avoid high amounts of sodium in the American diet is by avoiding things that are in a bag, a box, or a can. So that old rule of thumb of shopping the outside part of the supermarket and eating at home more often. So the amount of salt that comes from the table and the stove is at this point quite modest. So in my opinion, if you're on the healthy diet that we're talking about, where you're eating lots of whole grains and lots of fruits and vegetables and salads and so forth, and lean meat, fish and fowl, and low-fat dairy, and lots of legumes and nuts and seeds, then putting a little salt on your food at the table is perfectly fine, if that's your preference, as long as you don't have one of those conditions for which you're explicitly on a low-salt diet. And be sure to ask your clinician, is this really working? Because, again, for a lot of people, it doesn't work. So it's not really so much the cooking style at home cooking. Now, when you go to a restaurant, they use much, much more than most home cooks do. And certainly the little bit of table salt that people sprinkle on is rarely the problem. And again, there is a moderate amount, 10-15%, that's naturally occurring in food. But the vast majority is from processed foods. Now, what are these foods? Well, here's the list. This, again, is on a per capita basis. And you'll notice that it's very similar to the list that I showed you where calories come from in the United States. And the reason for this is primarily because we eat in restaurants a lot and we eat a lot of processed foods. And so it's the same list of foods that are both high in calories and high in sodium. So that's sort of interesting. And probably if I had done a survey and asked you what was the food from which the bulk of our sodium comes from in the United States, very few of you would have said bread. But again, in the spirit of eating less refined carbohydrates, it's a convenient concordance. Chicken and chicken mixed dishes, pizza, soda, energy drinks, and sports drinks, cold cuts. So there are a few dishes on here that weren't on the earlier list. And some of the foods that you think of as being particularly high in salt, like cold cuts, some condiments, sausage, and bacon, are definitely on the list. But the bulk of the list comes from breads and pizza and so forth that we saw before, and fast food in general. Okay. So if you have any questions about sodium, think of those, and we'll move on next to talk about fat. So just to orient you, because I'm going to talk about two types of fat, that when we talk about fat in the diet, fat is a chemical that has a long string of carbons connected. And depending on how they are connected is how we classify the fat. So if there are no double bonds, if it's all single bonded connections, we call that saturated fat. If there's one double bond in the molecule, we call it a monounsaturated fat. And the examples here are olive oil and canola oil. Polyunsaturated fat means there's a bunch of double bonds. And then it depends on where those double bonds are, how far away they are from the N-methyl end of the carbon structure. And if they're three carbons away, we call it omega-3. And if it's six carbons away, we call it omega-6. So, and then if you try to convert those double bonds and make them go away and throw some carbon in a processor on these fats, as a way to hydrogenate them, then you can make what's called trans hydrogenated fatty acids. And in nature, the double bonds, the carbons are mostly on the same side of the double bond. What those of you who remember your chemistry, this is called a cis configuration, and trans is when they're on the opposite side of the double bond, and then it turns out that's unhealthy. So food processing of fats to take unsaturated fats and make them saturated by adding a process to it allows it to be more solid at room temperature and more stable from shelf life. And so that's why that was invented. But it turned out that was pretty unhealthy. And one of the small victories, I think, and not so small, medium-sized victories in public health over the last decade has been the virtual elimination of trans hydrogenated fats from the American diet. Still not 100% there, but pretty much. And most of the fast food companies have either done that or have committed to doing it. And so we'll say, I just want to say a word then about saturated fat, and then a word or two about the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, saturated fat came back into the news in the last, I don't know, year or so because of some studies that suggested that at least from observational studies, again, these big population-based studies, that there was no clear benefit from diets in individuals in terms of cardiovascular outcomes between those who ate a more saturated fat from those who didn't. And that went against our teaching and some of the very, very first ecological studies of the 1950s, for example, that led to the recommendations that we've been living with for the last 60 years or so about low-fat diets and restrictions of saturated fat, came from these kind of studies. So this was a bit of a surprise, and it's looking at an additional pool of studies. And it was an unexpected finding, and whenever in medicine you get an unexpected finding, you need to say, okay, can this be repeated? Is this well done? Or is this really something new and important? And we don't know the answer to that yet, although this particular study has been criticized methodologically for a variety of reasons in terms of the studies they included and so on. So I would leave that as an open-ended question. That is, on a population base, can we prove that people who eat less saturated fat do better than those who eat more? I think open question. But we do know from different types of evidence that certain things happen when you eat saturated fat. So in lots of metabolic studies, randomized trials, experiments, that if you take people and put them on a metabolic ward, for example, and replace saturated fat with unsaturated fat, either polyunsaturated or monounsaturated fat, the total cholesterol goes down and the LDL cholesterol goes down. That's proven. So when we talk about a cholesterol-lowering diet, the mainstay of a cholesterol-lowering diet is reduction in total fat and saturated fat, especially saturated fat. You can get away without reducing total fat, but a reduction in saturated fat. If you replace a saturated fat with carbohydrates instead of with a better fat, now you're replacing it with carbohydrates as a traditional low-fat diet used to, then it also reduces your total and LDL or alpha-lousy cholesterol, but it increases your triglycerides and lowers your HDL. So in a metabolic setting, the issue may not just be the saturated fat, but what you replace it with. Okay? So back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, when we said low fat, low fat, low fat, what happened was we moved people away from fatty foods, and they were replaced by high calorie carbohydrate foods with refined grains and sweeteners. And that turned out not to be such a good idea. And at least that was coincident with our epidemic of obesity. So the take-home message here may be that if you want to replace saturated fat in your diet because of a specific therapeutic goal, because we don't know that you're going to benefit just in general, that's the top bullet. That hasn't been proven yet. But if you're looking for ways to non-pharmacologically treat your cholesterol, for example, then lowering your saturated fat and replacing it with a healthier fat is a good idea. And in general terms, we think that's probably beneficial even for those with normal cholesterol, but it may be less important. So again, take-home message here is it matters. So in general, we still recommend limiting saturated fat, but if you're eating a lot of it, what you replace it with to get to that lower number is important. And replace the take-home message is replace it with healthier fats. We also know that in the same context, not only does your LDL get better, but there are some studies suggesting that replacing saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat or monounsaturated fat, and I'll show you a specific recent study on that in just a moment, reduces cardiovascular disease. And again, reducing total fat with carbohydrates does not. So it matters what you use to replace your saturated fat. So operationally, nutritionally, you want to use oils that are liquid at room temperature, soy, corn, olive, and canola. If you're a big believer in monounsaturated fats, olive and canola, higher in those. But the evidence for polyunsaturated fats is also good, and more the soy and corn. My own view is, since I can't really taste the difference, very often I'll use canola oil because it's hot, more monounsaturated, where taste doesn't matter. It's a bland oil. It cooks well. And olive oil if I care about the taste. And you can do that to replace animal fats. Having said that, though, again, butter is fine as long as you're sensible at the amount of butter you use. And so choosing between a small amount of butter and a small amount of margarine, I think, is a toss-up. There's no evidence that one is better than the other. My personal preference is butter. But you wouldn't want to have a diet that was rich in butter, cream, and certainly not lard. And there's no real reason, except in a very specific recipe that you can think of that I might not, to use tropical oils. Those are purely saturated and are not necessary for standard cooking. So if you're going to believe in monounsaturated fats, that sort of leads us to the Mediterranean diet. And the Mediterranean diet comes from the observation that people who live in the Mediterranean basin on both sides, both northeast and southern part of the Mediterranean basin, and there are different dietary types. But in general, there are diets where people eat a lot of fat, but it's, quote, healthier fats. They eat a fair amount of carbs, but it's healthier carbs, fruits and vegetables and whole grains, and with a big side of fruits and vegetables. And so this is a nice cartoon that suggests some of the frequency with which one might eat certain foods. And at the top of the pyramid, this camp comes from the days of the pyramid, would be your rich meats and saturated fat meats on the top. That would be a relatively infrequent food choice. That the butters and cheeses maybe a little less often, although the French certainly are the exception to that. And then at the bottom of the pyramid, that you should be eating more regularly are the fruits and vegetables, healthy fats, whole grains, and so on. And you can see some little bit of olive oil there in the middle and some red wine in the upper left. Now, the folks at the Department of Nutrition at Harvard have put together this healthy eating plate, which is a takeoff on the MyPlate graphic. And it's similar, but again, fruits and vegetables are taking up half the plate, representing half of your intake over the course of the day, with a little bit more emphasis on green leafy vegetables and variety of vegetables and a variety of fruits. Olive oil or other healthy oils are now on the graphic. Dairy is not on this graphic. So the milk has been replaced by water. Again, we think that lean, low-fat and non-fat dairy is excellent to include in the diet for reasons that I'll emphasize towards the end. And then, of course, whole grains and healthy protein. So a little bit more opinion focusing on the quality of the food than even MyPlate does. MyPlate does it if you drill down on that graphic, but this is an attempt to be more specific about the grains being whole and the protein being healthy. Now, in a study that has not yet been reproduced, and again, always makes me look at it a little bit skeptically, but it got a lot of press, and it's certainly an interesting study. This was a randomized trial, so this is now not an observational study. This is an experiment. Where they took almost 7,500 individuals from Spain, and these were people who had some diabetes or cardiovascular disease, other cardiovascular disease risk factors. They followed them for 5 years, and what they did was they divided them up into three groups, and half the patients they said, watch your diet, eat less fat. And they gave them some general instructions on eating less fat. They didn't do a lot to them, and they became the control group. And then the experimental group was divided in half, and one half got 4 tablespoons per day of olive oil, and the other group got an ounce of nuts. Now, I will say, this study was funded by the makers of olive oil and nuts. That doesn't mean it's bad. And I don't mean to imply that at all. My timing suggested that it was, you know, you should be suspicious, but that's not my point. Because this was a randomized trial, and both the patients and the investigators were blinded as to the outcomes. Obviously, you weren't blinded as to who got the nuts, but you didn't know who had the heart attack. And at the end of the day, the people in the nuts in the olive oil group did better. And so they had less cardiovascular events that were statistically significant than the people in the control group. So this got published as, and again, it was reduced by about, the absolute reduction is about 1%. So for every 100 people in this study who got the nuts or olive oil over 5 years, you would have one less heart attack. So again, if you think about those, percent reduced of what, you can get some idea of what I'm talking about. So it wasn't a dramatic effect, but it was statistically significant. And there are so few randomized trials in nutrition that this got a lot of attention, especially with diet. So it turns out, though, that all the subjects in this study, they were Spaniards. And so most of them, and I think the study was done in Barcelona, most of them were already on a diet that, by American standards, we would consider Mediterranean. Now, they had a 10-point scale to define how Mediterranean you were, and they weren't the highest Mediterranean diet, but I think they were like 8 on a scale of 10, and we might be 3. So these were people who already were eating a Mediterranean diet. And so it wasn't really a comparison of a low-fat diet with a Mediterranean diet. In my opinion, it was really a comparison of adding oil and nuts to not adding oil and nuts to people who were already eating a relatively healthy diet. But I think it's pretty good evidence that adding oil and nuts may be beneficial. Again, only study, but provocative and consistent with other lines of evidence. Remember, though, that nuts are high in calories. This particular study used tree nuts. It did not include, it was walnuts, hazelnuts, and almonds, if I remember. It did not include pistachios, but there's no reason to think that pistachio wouldn't have the same effect. But remember that nuts, a very small handful of nuts is several hundred calories. So, again, very healthy, but build them into your daily budget so you don't overdo it. All right, next I'm going to talk about vegetarian diets. So as I implied on the first slide, if someone says they're a vegetarian, I nod my head and I say to myself, all right, well, I still don't know anything about their diet. And if I really want to know, then I have to ask more questions. And if you read the literature or talk to people about who calls themselves vegetarian, this is 7 different ways that people call themselves vegetarian, and I'm sure I've left some off. So vegans, fruitarians, lacto-vegetarians, lacto-ovo, that means milk or milk and eggs. Pesco is obviously fish. Pollo vegetarians is chicken, and flexitarians or semi-vegetarians are people who eat meat, fish, or fowl, but not frequently. Monthly or something like that. So again, people use this word to mean all sorts of things. Now, we've known for a long time that if you do observational studies of people who are vegetarian diet and compare them with people who are meat eaters, a lot of the studies suggest that the vegetarians live longer. But a lot of those are studies where there are other health behaviors amongst the vegetarians that might confound the result. So, for example, a lot of the studies are among Seventh-day Adventists who have a very low rate of cigarette use, alcohol, and so forth. So one nice study that they did was an observational study only in Seventh-day Adventist community. So it sort of eliminated how strong your faith was and whether you smoke or drank or so on. It was because everyone was in the same boat, at least religiously and culturally. And they divided people up based upon what they ate and what they were with more careful definitions of what they ate. And they compared vegans, pesco, lacto-ovo, and semi-vegetarians to the non-vegetarians within the group. So now all Seventh-day Adventists allows us to control. And the in general, the main take-home was that the vegetarians did better than the non-vegetarians. So that was reinforced what we had thought before. And the lowest mortality, that is the best outcome, was the best health outcomes were in the vegans, but the pesco vegetarians did just as well. And again, these are subsets, so it's a little bit of a reach to draw too much from this. But I think you can say that it appears that eating a vegetarian diet, at least you can say with confidence that eating a vegetarian diet is safe. We've known this for 40 years. And it's so safe that I can say clinically that there is no disease or phase of life in which a vegetarian diet or even a vegan diet cannot be safely used. So if you believe in vegan diets, you can use it. And we need to talk about a few things, but not much. And certainly more mixed vegetarian diets like lacto-ovo vegetarian diets, there's no clinical indication for not using those. If you want it, you can do it. And maybe if you restrict all animal products, maybe you do a little bit better, but maybe fish is just as good. So, but interesting study. So we do support vegetarian diets and those who choose to eat them. I would never tell a patient not to eat a vegetarian diet. And for some patients, it's really quite an effective way to change their diet and accomplish many of the other goals that we talked about. But just by restricting meat, fish, or fowl doesn't mean you're eating a healthy diet. You have to go. You have to eat a healthy diet and then restrict meat, fish, or fowl. Okay, what about antioxidants? We'll move to supplements, and I'll move a little bit more quickly. there's not much good news here. For those of you who take, I won't embarrass you and ask you to raise your hand, how many are taking antioxidant supplements, but generally we recommend against. There have now been 47 high-quality randomized trials of various antioxidants. The logic here made all the sense in the world that if you had fat-soluble antioxidants such as beta-carotene or vitamin E or water-soluble antioxidants such as vitamin C, since death is a form of oxidation and disease is a form of oxidation, it would be logical that if you had more antioxidants that you would have less disease. Unfortunately, that's not true. And so all these randomized studies have basically shown that not only is there no benefit, there's actually potential harm. So vitamin A supplements, worse mortality. Beta-carotene, I used to have a slide back 30 years ago that said beta-carotene, no known toxicity. Wrong. Because at least in Finnish smokers, where many of these studies were done, there was an increase in mortality, even with the benign beta-carotene. Vitamin E has shown an increase, and vitamin C has shown an increase. And all of these are statistically significant, except vitamin C, but the point estimate's in the same direction. So we used to be, and you'll see later in, as we go through some of these, there's some of these that I'm sort of neutral on because they don't work, but they're not harmful. And if you want to take them, you know, that's good. I won't, but that's okay. But there are some things I actively recommend against to patients, and antioxidants would be on that list. So if you want to take a multivitamin because you think you have insufficient vitamin and mineral intakes, we think that's probably safe. And for some people, like people who are of reproductive potential, it's actually indicated. But taking the higher doses, the so-called mega doses, or even moderately high doses of these vitamins shown here may be disadvantageous. Folic acid is another sad story. A lot of evidence now of both cardiovascular disease and cancers. And here the logic has been that we know that people who have high homocysteine in the blood have increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Therefore, it was logical that if you could lower the homocysteine, people would have less cardiovascular disease. So the experiments were done. And in fact, when you lower the homocysteine with B vitamins, people get no benefit. So if you give people folic acid or vitamin B12, for example, or other B vitamins and lower the homocysteine goes down as desired, but there's no impact on any medical impact on heart disease, cancer, or death. So folic acid does not prevent, or B vitamins don't prevent cancer or heart disease. They're safe as opposed to the antioxidants, but they don't work. The one exception is for neural tube defects, and this has become a little bit less of an issue in the United States because grains have been supplemented with folic acid. But we still recommend doing whatever we can to make sure that women of childbearing potential have adequate folic acid. So young women, especially who need small amounts of calories per day and may not be on the best diet, should take a prenatal type vitamin to prevent folic acid defect, neural tube defects. The issue is that these are formed very early in pregnancy before your pregnancy test turns positive. So women of childbearing age should be adequate in folic acid well before they know they're pregnant, since half of pregnancies in the United States are unplanned. Okay, what about omega-3 fatty acids, everyone's favorite? So just to, again, remind you where you are on the fat map. So these are one of the polyunsaturated. We call it omega-3 because of where the double bond is in relation to the end of the carbon chain. And these are high in fish, walnuts, flaxseed, and soybeans. And there was a study about a decade or so ago, a big cardiology study, had one of the fancy cardiology names, and a lot of patients, and it suggested that people who took omega-3 fatty acids had less sudden death, so less unexplained death from irregular heartbeats. So that put folic acid on the map. Omega-3 fatty acids on the map. But the sad news is that the studies since then have all been negative. So we're now up to 48, actually 50. I'll show you two more in a minute. Randomized trials of omega-3 fatty acids. You take them, you don't. See what happens after 5 years or so. And there's no significant effect on mortality, cardiovascular events, or cancer. Interestingly, the diets that were rich in omega-3s also don't show any benefit. And again, though there's no harm, so in general, when patients say they're taking omega-3 fatty acids, I say, that's okay if you want. I don't recommend it. I think you're wasting your money. I may not say that, but you might be. There may also be calories from the omega-3s, so check the bottle, but there's no benefit. So that's disappointing. Now, that's different than using omega-3s in triple the dose as a drug to lower high blood triglyceride. That's different. Sometimes we use omega-3s as a medication at super normal doses. But in terms of the vitamin-like dose you take as a tonic to prevent heart disease, it doesn't work. And two other studies published in the last year or two, again, reinforce that it doesn't work. So no reduction in death from another big study of 12,000 patients, and a second big study, 12,000 patients, no reduction in death or cardiovascular. So with 50 studies now, we're pretty convinced that this doesn't work. All right, the vitamin du jour is vitamin D. I know Eliseo touched on this briefly, and I will as well. Because many doctors have been starting to measure vitamin D, and if the measurement suggests that you're insufficient, then recommending a supplement. And, of course, some patients on their own have been taking supplements. And, again, this comes from a lot of this association kind of studies that suggested that people on lower vitamin D intakes might have more cancer, heart disease, diabetes, autoimmune disorders, cognitive decline, and other conditions. But the bottom line is there's no evidence to support that line of evidence. And so the Institute of Medicine and our federal government's prevention task force, the so-called United States Preventive Services Task Force, have both determined in the last year or so that there's no data to support benefits of screening patients for low vitamin D or treating low vitamin D in all comers. Now, that's not to say that under certain circumstances, certain people shouldn't take vitamin D, but as a tonic for everyone, we don't recommend it yet. the current recommendation, though, is to take enough vitamin D, like any nutrient, including the antioxidants and folate and everything else. You want to make sure you're taking enough. And so for people who have food insecurity, alcoholics, people difficulty maintaining their body weight and their calorie intake, various diseases. There are all sorts of reasons why your nutritional intake may be suboptimal. And there are many nutrients in the United States of which we are at risk of insufficiency. And vitamin D and calcium are on that list. So it's not to say that you shouldn't be sufficient, right? You want to assess your intake and make sure you're getting enough. But if you're once you're getting enough, there's no advantage of more. Okay, and that's sort of a rule of thumb of almost any nutrition in a bottle. The current enoughs have been recently redefined. So the Institute of Medicine says 600 for those under age 70 and 800 if you're over 70, and that's an increase from 400 to 600. So there is an appreciation that we need a bit more. And if you take that amount, it would on average lead to a serum concentration of about 20 nanograms per milliliter. And that is a normal blood level. So there are many laboratories, including our own until a month ago, when we finally got them to change, said that 30 was the limit. But that's not correct. The lower limit is 20. And so if you're between 20 and 30, you do not have a vitamin D deficiency and should not take a supplement. On the other hand, we do recommend that you eat enough vitamin D. And vitamin D is fortified in many foods, including those shown here, including milk, yogurt, soy beverages, orange juice, various cereals, and fatty fish. All of which, that one's natural, all of which are relatively rich in vitamin D. And so we're talking about 3 to 4 servings a day of these kind of foods to meet your adequacy. And if for some reason that's impossible, then taking a low-dose supplement may be indicated. But don't think you're going to have less heart disease or cancer or bone disease because of it. You're just preventing deficiency. And that dose should be sufficient for 97% of the population. So the big take-home message here is that if you're had a blood test because in the last 5 years doctors have jumped on this bandwagon and started checking people, especially older people, especially people who spend a lot of time indoors about vitamin D, if your vitamin D level is well below 20 and probably repeated, then you should be take a supplement and get over 20. But between 20 and 30, you probably don't need to do anything special. And if you have not yet had it checked, don't, because it's not recommended that you have it checked. But many of you probably already have. Now, this is if you have bone disease, it's a little bit different. And so if you're taking bisphosphonates for osteoporosis, or have low bone density, then checking is part of the evaluation of low bone density. But it's not, I'm talking now routinely for the public at large. Calcium, the story is sort of similar. It makes sense, you would think, since both calcium and vitamin D are necessary for bone health. We know that, and so it makes sense that if you had a little bit extra, your bones would be a little bit thicker or more dense, and it turns out that that's not true. So food here, too, is the preferred approach, and there's no routine recommendations for supplements, but you can consider supplements if your intake is inadequate. And recent studies in which patients have people have taken calcium supplements have been shown to have increased cardiovascular risk. So now these are mostly people who have taken calcium without vitamin D. This literature is very hard to interpret. But remember that atherosclerosis is, quote, hardening of the arteries, and calcium deposits in the blood vessels is how it manifests itself. And so it may be unrelated, but nonetheless, people there are some studies that suggest that maybe it's not as safe as we thought. So what are the recommendations? About 1,000 milligrams a day for the younger, and 1,200 a day if you're older, 50 that being 50 in women and 70 in men. And you probably should not take in more than 2 grams a day. Now, remember that these numbers are supplements plus what you're eating. So this is not supplement dose. This is supplement plus what you're eating. And depending on what you're eating, if you and I have been on the same page through most of the night, then you're probably eating a bit more than you realize, especially if you include low-fat dairy or any dairy in your diet. This is the amount of dietary calcium per dish, per serving. Remember now, our goal here is about 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams a day, and you get about a third to a halfway there with a serving of yogurt, almost similar with cheese, milk, and so forth. So it's if you include dairy in your diet, it's not hard to meet your calcium requirements. If you do not include dairy in your diet, for whatever reason, it is hard to meet your calcium requirements. Other sources are fruits and vegetables, as shown here, the best being fortified orange juice. So I did say don't drink any calories, but I'm being a little glib, because low-fat milk and fortified orange juice might be two things I would put on the list, depending on your nutritional requirements. And green leafy vegetables are also relatively rich in calcium, but not compared to dairy. And I always tell people that canned fish with the bones are a terrific source of calcium, but no one eats canned fish with the bones anymore. So, but if you like it, they are an excellent source of dietary calcium. And then some commercial grains are fortified with calcium and often vitamin D as well, as shown here. That's not a typo. Some are highly fortified in calcium. So to summarize, this is a area of controversy, so it's less well-developed than the issues related to omega-3s, for which we have 50 studies, antioxidants and folic acid, for which we have a lot of studies. This one's still developing, but it has been reviewed by experts as follows, that to routinely take calcium and vitamin D as an aspiration to prevent fractures later in life, there's insufficient evidence to recommend that. If you want to take supplements over a vitamin D3 and calcium, insufficient evidence to recommend that. If you want to take low doses, that's a typo. It should be less than 400 D3 and less than 1,000 calcium. That we actively discourage, and that's confusing. But the reason that's like that, because there have been some big studies that have been negative. Whereas with the ones that say I means there's insufficient evidence, the D means we actively discourage it. So a little bit of the supplements we discourage, but if you want to take more, the reason to do it would be if your diet was insufficient. And then there is some, and then screening for vitamin D deficiency, there's insufficient evidence and it's not recommended. And there is some evidence that for people who are at very, very high risk of falls, independent of the impact on bone, that is, there may be an impact on muscle function, vitamin D may be indicated. So that's the one place where vitamin D may show up. Now, again, if you're being treated for bone disease, I'm not talking about you, right? So if you're on a bisphosphonate or other osteoporosis medicine, we routinely prescribe a calcium and vitamin D because we're trying to make new bone and you need those micronutrients to do that. But we're talking now about public health and individuals who are otherwise well. And again, if you're really low, we should correct it. So to summarize, beta-carotene we think is harmful. Vitamin E we think is harmful. Folic acid we think is important to prevent neural tube defects, but not effective for heart disease and cancer. And omega-3s are no benefit, but as far as we can tell, no major harm. So let me end with just a couple of moments of philosophy. Most of you are familiar with Michael Pollan's three rules. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. It's sort of hard to improve on this. So this is good, and I strongly reinforce this approach. It's a little bit how I think about medicine in general. Which is see doctors, not too much, mostly primary care. So even though I say it's too a little hard to improve on that, I'll try to emphasize some of the points we've made. Eat unprocessed foods predominantly. Eat the right amount to maintain your body weight. Eat something colorful at every meal. This is particularly important with children, but it's also true for adults. We don't count Skittles. Snacks should also be colorful. Eliminating white foods, with the exception of low-fat dairy, is a good goal. Don't drink any calories, except for the occasional wine, if you're one of those, or maybe some low-fat milk or dairy, and supplemented orange juice is another option. This is maybe more a little bit of life philosophy than it is nutrition advice. But if you can't make the best choice, make a better choice. Right? You're not always in a situation to control every part of your life, but often there are options. And so even if you're at someone else's house or a cafeteria or a restaurant that you wouldn't want to normally go to, there are better choices. Be as fit as you can be. Exercise every day. I didn't talk much about that tonight, but the goal is 6 days a week. Exercising should be biblical, one day of rest per week. And don't go to bed tonight without thinking about how in your busy schedule you can exercise tomorrow. And for those of you with kids, be sure to eat with your children and eat at home. It's been very frustrating to, as an observer of this scientific debate over the last 30 years of one diet versus another. And I think if you really drill through the noise and the commercialism and the academic biases of individuals on one extreme, whether it's paleo or vegan and everything, or low carb and high, low fat and everything in between, basically what it comes down to is if you really pin people down, everyone agrees with the following, that if you limit sugar, refined grains, and large amounts of saturated and trans fat, you're doing a good thing. And if you eat more fruits and vegetables, healthy oils, whole grains, legumes, and nuts, you're doing a good thing. And everyone will agree to that. And on the margin, they may say, well, you can do that without meat, or you can do that without grains. Have that argument. But that's not what's important. What's important is in the middle here with these principles. So master a generic diet that you can control yourselves. So with that, I think I'll stop. I've included on the slides some useful resources. The most recent is the new Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which just came out last month. This is about a 100-page document. It's terrific. So if you're so inclined, please take a look at that. And then a variety of other websites. And with that, I'll thank you very much for your attention. So I did go a bit longer than I intended, but I will be happy to entertain questions. We'll do 10 minutes max. Yes. So the question is, am I familiar with monk fruit and stevia? A little bit, and I don't know enough. Not enough is known about them to say convincing. There's no evidence that they're better in diabetics or people trying to lose weight. So that we can say convincingly, we do not yet know that they're better. Again, my own personal bias is that it may cultivate a sweet food preference, and it may be better for you in the long run not to go that way, and rather just in the same way as you can retrain your taste buds in 2 or 3 months to prefer lower salt foods, you can also retrain your taste buds to prefer lower sweet foods. And those may be valuable things to do. So that now I'm in opinion, but there's no evidence that it's better. In the back? No. So the question is, what about vitamin E for memory loss? And there are a few older randomized trials that did show. In fact, they were part of the original studies that we used that also showed some effect with some of the currently used medications. And there is, on some scales, on average, a slight improvement in a cognitive decline. These are in patients with cognitive impairment. So these are not healthy people who can't remember, what the last book you read was. That's normal, right? But for people with cognitive decline, some neurologists keep vitamin E in the armamentarium. As an alternative to some of the commonly used medications. The truth of the matter is, if you read that literature carefully, whether it's vitamin E or the different classes of medications, the amount of improvement is quite modest. So it's based on scales that are very broad with small improvements that reach statistical significance. And so since there's a range, a Gaussian range of response to any intervention, there may be some patients who benefit, but there's a lot of patients who don't. And so with any of those medicines, including vitamin E, if we initiate them, we say, and let's talk in 3 months about whether you see an improvement in your father who's taking this medication. But yes, vitamin E is on that list. Not super strong, but there I'm thinking of it as a medication and not as a tonic for everyone to take. Yes. Is there any benefit for omega-3 for brain health? Not that has been demonstrated in the scientific literature. So again, the thinking is that everything bad is an oxidative process. And the thinking is that if you can create more antioxidants, that everything would do better. So whether it's plaque in the brain or dying off of brain cells, you would do better if there were more antioxidants, but it hasn't been proven. So we do recommend, even though the evidence here is weak also, we do recommend that you eat a diet high in omega-3 fatty acids. So some of the oils that I mentioned, and flax, and canola oils, and so forth, fatty fish are highly recommended as part of a healthy diet. And we think that will give you plenty of omega-3. But at this point, there's nothing to recommend supplements. But again, there's no harm. So it's right now, we think it's safe, but ineffective. Yes. So the question is, as you age, you lose muscle mass. What can you do to slow that down? Well, there are a variety of things you can do which are illegal or medically inadvisable. So please don't do those in terms of steroids and testosterone and so forth. Of course, testosterone supplements have become an industry. And much like vitamin D, the measurements are incorrect and probably have created an abnormality when none exists. The range of normal testosterone in men and women is extremely broad, and so it's very hard to divide that up into an insufficient level. So, and we're now appreciating that testosterone supplements are associated with increased risk of heart attacks and stroke, so you have to be very cautious with that. Having said that, the only correct answer to what do you do to preserve muscle mass is use your muscles. So remember, there are four pillars to fitness. We usually talk about cardiovascular exercise, but it also includes resistance training, flexibility training, and balance. And if you want to preserve your lean body mass or muscle mass, you want to use your muscles, and the best way to do that is with resistance training.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.